My ears were ringing yesterday in this room, so if the mic gets too loud, just let me know, would you? And I'll back up a little bit. So I'm going to spend a brief time this morning just talking about sort of some linkages between human health and the ways that animals are produced. Oops. For food in this country. I don't have any relationships to disclose. Just wanted to list the objectives for the talk here. The first thing to realize is that most meat production in the U.S. today is in an industrialized setting. And, you know, these are called CAFOs, or confined animal feeding operations, or industrial animal production, or even factory farms, more colloquially. But what it means, basically, is that the animals are raised in settings that are very confined, either indoors for poultry or swine or outdoors for cattle. They're largely raised on feed, corn and soybeans, which we've got a lot of, rather than on grass as cattle were designed to be raised on or forage. It's very large-scale production, so some of these farms can be 100,000 birds. They can be 5,000 head or swine animals, or, you know, tens of thousands of cattle in one place. It's very specialized and it's very concentrated, which has implications for pollution and especially manure waste, because there are so many animals and they're often in a fairly tight geographic area, so there's literally no place to put the waste. And then one of the features that I'm going to focus on is that tying a lot of these things together is the routine use of antimicrobial agents. This is because this kind of a facility for producing animals introduces a lot of infectious agents into an indoor environment, so there's a lot of infection control problems, and it also stresses the animal's immune systems and makes them more predisposed to getting infections. And then finally, I'll get to that later, but the antimicrobial use, by any estimate, is huge. And we have trouble tracking the exact number because, as a society, Americans have opted not to track antibiotic use. So we don't actually know the real number. But industry or nonprofits like the Union of Concerned Scientists or the National Academy of Sciences, they all basically agree that it's between 20 and 30 million pounds of antimicrobials used in agriculture every year. And the problem is that a lot of these approved uses by the FDA predated what we know about the possibility of these uses contributing to the overall problem of antibiotic resistance. So, of course, antibiotics are used to treat sick animals, right? But it appears that the far greater usage is the routine addition of antibiotics to animal feed for the purpose of making the animal put on weight faster, using less feed, getting to market faster, and also for avoiding infection when the animals are being raised in conditions that are conducive to infection or greater infection. And so there's a lot of problems with this feed usage. One of them is that it's not by prescription, it's over the counter. So you can literally go to a feed store and buy a 50-pound bag of tetracycline like this. It's not just antibiotics that fall into the category of antimicrobials, it's also things like heavy metals, like arsenical products. These are arsenic compounds or other kinds of drugs. But there are a number of different antibiotics, and these include many that are also used in human medicine, so penicillins, tetracyclines, erythromycins, sulfa drugs. So the obvious concern there is that the use of these drugs in agriculture is going to undercut their effectiveness for treating human infections. So a little micro 101, this is Charles Darwin. And he identified this, as I'm sure all you know, this concept of natural selection. And if the schematic here represents a group of bacteria, and the little dusty powder there is the addition of antibiotics to the bacterial environment, what this demonstrates is that if there is a naturally resistant strain of bacteria in that environment, the continued presence of antibiotics is going to select for that resistant strain and allow it to propagate. Well, there's an additional characteristic of bacteria, and that is that they're smart about these genes and other materials that make them resistant to antibiotics. They go out and acquire resistance genes from other bacteria. They basically are promiscuous with these resistance genes. They swap them both among closely related bacteria, but also across different families of bacteria. They can go out and get these resistance genes from the environment. So if you imagine a big manure pit filled with antibiotics and resistant bacteria, it's sort of a reservoir for unresistant bacteria to go out and find these resistance genes and pick them up. And then a third characteristic is that these genes that make a bacteria resistant often don't exist just by themselves. They're physically linked on long pieces of DNA that contain multiple resistance genes. And this has a couple of different implications. One is that in a snap, if a bacteria gets this whole section of DNA, it becomes resistant to multiple antibiotics at once. The other implication is that a bacteria need only be exposed to one of these antibiotics to provide the selection pressure for it to go out and pick up the DNA that's going to make it resistant to several different antibiotics. And the genes that make it resistant to antibiotics can also make the bacteria resistant to heavy metals. So heavy metal resistance is linked with bacterial resistance. So I'm not going to go into a lot of the detail in the brief talk, but suffice it to say that the scientific consensus emerging is that this heavy use of antibiotics is in fact selecting for resistance that's transmitted to the human population. And it gets transmitted, we think, mostly through contaminated food. So most of the meat you buy at the retail level now has bacteria on it resistant to at least one antibiotic. Much of it has bacteria resistant to multiple antibiotics. And this is an unrecognized way in which people are being colonized with antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria. But we also know that the farmers who use these antibiotics, who put them in animal feed, very quickly can be colonized with drug-resistant strains. And even the broader environment where the manure is, most of these antibiotics given to animals go right into the manure. And then the manure and wherever it is applied ends up becoming a reservoir for antibiotic-resistant bacteria and antibiotic residues as well. So, how am I doing at time? Okay. So most of the risks from these practices that have been looked at have been sort of acknowledged foodborne pathogens like Salmonella and Campylobacter, the two major causes of foodborne illness. And so Fred Angulo, a veterinarian epidemiologist at CDC, for example, has suggested that much of the drug-resistant Salmonella that is in the human population can be traced back to this practice of using antibiotic in food animals. And similarly, when there have been certain antibiotics given to animals, in this case fluoroquinolones, which weren't added to animal feed, but they were given to poultry flocks for therapy, and the FDA became concerned that this practice was leading to Cipro-resistant or fluoroquinolone-resistant Campylobacter, and they went on to estimate that over 150,000 people a year were actually contracting Cipro-resistant or fluoroquinolone-resistant Campy infections from eating chicken that was so contaminated. Now, fortunately, FDA then went on to ask that the companies take these poultry fluoroquinolones off the market. But it was a very protracted process. It took more than 5 years. One of the companies immediately agreed, the other didn't, and had to go through a protracted legal process until finally the product was taken off the poultry market. So all that is by way of introduction to what I want to talk today is about some of the emerging resistant bacterial strains, or superbugs, if you will, that seem to be linked from the farm and food environment to the human population. And I'm not going to talk much about MRSA, but I'm just going to do that as a lead-in to the next speaker. And instead, I'm going to focus on resistant extra-intestinal E. coli infections. So E. coli, as many of you know, is a very common bacteria in the human gut, but it also causes infections outside of the gut. It can cause, for example, neonatal meningitis, urinary tract infections, bacteremia. In fact, it's a much more significant cause of bacteremia among elderly people than is pneumococcus. And in fact, there's some evidence that fluoroquinolones that I was just talking about creating resistant Campylobacter bacteria also help to create resistant E. coli bacteria. And Jim Johnson in Minnesota and others have written about this. And in fact, they found that they can isolate fluoroquinolone-resistant E. coli from retail chicken, and it's very similar to the human isolates. It has a similar molecular fingerprint. And in fact, the evidence suggests that many of the fluoroquinolone-resistant E. coli infections in people are actually being imported from chickens. The second example are community-acquired ESBL carrying E. coli, okay? This stands for extended spectrum beta-lactamase resistant E. coli. And the resistance is conferred by these genes that I just listed, and it confers resistance to oral antibiotics, but also these really newer classes of third and fourth generation cephalosporins. Well, why is this significant if you're not a microbiologist? It's because these are sort of last gun therapies. They're some of the biggest guns in the arsenal of an infectious disease doctor. So we use them when nothing else is working, basically, because they're effective, or should be effective, against both gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria. And the problem is that now we're seeing community strains of E. coli that are resistant to these third and fourth generation cephalosporins. So in the UK, this is a very significant source of human infection with about 30,000 estimated cases a year, rivaling MRSA, I might add. And it appears that food may be an important vehicle for spreading these superbugs. A third-generation cephalosporin that's widely used in agriculture is called ceftiofur. And in fact, we've seen a rather dramatic increase in salmonella strains that are ceftiofur resistant in animals. But there's some evidence for E. coli that's resistant to these cephalosporins as well in food. And I'm not going to go into details, but these are several studies that have come out in the last 5 or 6 years, for example, including the last one noting the first appearance in meat sold in Denmark of these ESBL carrying strains of E. coli. So, and I'm running a little bit over. So here's one example. We use third-generation cephalosporins widely in food animals around the world, including ceftiofur, but we don't just have to worry about the approved uses, although there are many of those. We have to also worry about something called extra-label use. And basically, animal drugs are kind of funky from a human perspective because once you get an approval of a particular drug for one use, the veterinarian has discretion to use it off-label for any other use in any other animal. So it's called off-label use. And unless it's specifically prohibited, there's wide latitude to do that. So for example, it came out several years ago that ceftiofur, even though it wasn't approved formally for this use was widely injected into hatchery eggs for about 500 million chickens a year. So, yep. So just to wrap up, there are federal and other policies that promote cephalosporin use. There's policies and also the lack of enforcement of policies. So even when there's label restraints in the use of these cephalosporins, for example, in Australia, they're widely ignored by the agricultural regulators. There's this extra label use problem that I talked about. And then there's the fact that within some of the multinational processes, they set standards for residues of cephalosporins in meat that are higher than for some of the other drugs. And basically, this steers farmers to use preferentially these broad-spectrum cephalosporins rather than a narrower spectrum drug. So I'm going to skip to the last point, which is I think there's a lot more that could be done for a policy standpoint to address some of these issues. And the American Veterinary Medical Association and the AMA last year announced a One Medicine, or I guess you could call it a One Health initiative, basically recognizing the importance of this linkage between animal health and human health. But I would submit that more needs to be done to recognize this linkage in terms of these emerging strains of bacteria like MRSA, like ESBL carrying E. coli. And in fact, more has to be done and hopefully promoted by both these organizations to promote sustainable agricultural practices that would prevent use of antibiotics in the first place. Thank you, and I'm over, so I'm going to wrap up here.
Thank you, David. That was a really interesting and terrific summary, and lots of good information there. Thank you. Our next speaker is John Balbus. He's the Chief Health Scientist for the environmental NGO, Environmental